Climate Change, Why Facts and Opinions Are Both Important. This is the third forum in the 2014 Fenner Forum series, hosted by the Fenner School of Environment and Society at the Australian National University. This forum took place on the 4th of September 2014.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thank you very much for coming along. I'm Steve Dovers, the director of the Fenner School. I'll chair the forum. Is that sound okay now that I've moved it away? Great. I'm delighted to welcome you here to the ANU for this third Fenner Forum for 2014. And a particular welcome to our guests from the local senior high school community who are studying in the Bachelor of Studies program through ANU Extension. And you're by far the most important part of this audience, because when people like I are playing lawn bowls, you'll be in charge. It's not as far off as you think. And in welcoming you here today, we acknowledge the and celebrate the first Australians on whose lands we meet here today, and pay our respects to the elders of the Ngunnawal people, both past and present. For those of you unfamiliar with the Fenner School of Environment Society, it's a leading centre for research training and education in environment and sustainability, spanning the natural and social sciences and the humanities. This series of fora are aimed at generating exchange of ideas and discussion around future challenges related to some of the major issues facing Australia and humanity. The two previous fora dealt with issues around energy and fire, and the fourth on the 7th of October will focus on water. But tonight our topic is climate, and it gives me great pleasure to introduce our panel for this evening, who will speak to the topic, the relationship between facts and opinions in response to climate change, from four different perspectives. And I will introduce them all now, and then they will perform in order. Our first perspective is a natural science perspective, which will be presented by Michael Raupach, who is the director of the Climate Change Institute here at the ANU. His scientific interests include the Earth system, carbon-climate-human interactions and land-air interactions. He's worked extensively with the Global Carbon Project, which is a major international project, and has led the Academy of Science, Australian Academy of Science, project negotiating our future living scenarios for 2050. They're in order, it's really easy. Our second speaker, who will give a social and psychological science perspective, is Professor Michael Smithson. He's a professor in the Research School of Psychology here at the ANU, and his interests are in judgment and decision making under science and uncertainty, and statistical methods for the human sciences. I'm glad that you're not doing the stats tonight, but more on the other part. Heather Brewer will give us an advocacy perspective. Heather is engaged in the Master of Climate Change here at the ANU and is a professional climate change campaigner, and has worked with diverse groups in Australia and internationally on climate change, and particularly focus on engaging young people to take action to protect their future. And our grand finale act is Will Grant, who will give us a science communication perspective. Will Grant is, I will quote this, a writer, talker and researcher at the Australian National Centre for the Public Awareness of Science here at the ANU. So you can get a job to be a talker. Most of Will's work is focused on the interaction of science, politics and climate change, and how such interactions are changing with new technology. And if you're interested, he tweets at WillowZap. Commence tweeting. So the format for this evening is that each of our four panellists will speak for no more than 10 minutes, and I will be sitting directly in their line of sight, waving a bit of paper at about 8 minutes or so. And then we have an open discussion at the end, which I'll facilitate. And the discussion is in the form of question and answer, not supplementary speeches from the floor. And afterwards, we'll be most delighted if you'll join us for refreshments in the foyer in the other part of the building. Please turn your mobile phone off. I have already. If you'd like to tweet, please feel free to do so. And we are recording this forum, so please be aware of that. Bathrooms can be found down the back stairs at the bottom of there, and that's all we need. So I will now invite our first presenter, Professor Michael Raupach.
Thank you very much, and thank you all for being here. It's a pleasure and a privilege to speak at this venue, in part because this exercise, this event, is joint with the Climate Change Institute. We run a series called the Climate Change Colloquia, and we're running a shared event here. I'd like to begin by asking a simple question. I'm going to give you a choice of three, and I'd like you to raise your hand for one, but not more. If this is the natural sciences, and this is the human sciences, and we sit in the middle, how many of you would identify with that end? How many here, and how many in the middle? Let's vote for that end first. How many would identify over there? Okay. Right. No, there's some. How many at this end? Some more. How many in the middle? Fantastic. So, my job is easy. I would like to convince you, and I appear to have no need of convincing you, that in this relationship between facts and opinions about climate change, that they're both critically important. Facts, objective science, tell us how the world works, and opinions, narratives, values, tell us how we act. They shape how we act. And, of course, the critical interaction between these in the current era, often called the Anthropocene, is that increasingly the way we act is shaping the natural world around us. There is a full feedback between these. Now, one of the things about facts is that routinely, and we see examples every day, they're mangled in the climate discourse. I'll just look at a couple of examples in a moment. Regrettably, they're not only mangled by the so-called contrarian end of the climate debate. And a couple of facts that are difficult and that routinely get, misused, the warming hiatus, the fact that, and it is a fact, that there has been no increase in surface temperature over the last 10 years, and the so-called carbon quota, the limit on the amount of carbon that we can emit. And the ways in which this mangling happens are several. We may fail to tell the truth, and this often involves mistakes, lack of insight, our lack of ability as researchers to perceive what's really out there. We wrestle with this all the time. We may fail to tell the whole truth. This is even more common, and it involves the phenomenon of confirmation bias, which I'm sure will be mentioned again. I'll mention it myself in a little while. But most importantly, we may fail to tell nothing but the truth. There may be deliberate lying by omission or commission. And this, of course, is the most serious way in which we can traduce, we can violate facts. And the most important point I want to make in this very short 10 minutes is that facts are hard to come by. They're difficult. They need to be treated with great respect because of that. Here is a collection of facts. This is a set of 10 pieces of information, records over the last anywhere up to 150 years of changes in our climate. They range from air temperature, top left, down to features to do with ice, the extent of Antarctic ice cover and glacier mass at the bottom right. And what we see, of course, is on one level the obvious. We see that indeed climate change is happening. Temperature's going up, ice is going down. But I want to point out here, and the reason for putting this up, is two things which are slightly less obvious. The first is that in this picture, there is concealed a great deal of dynamism. It's not concealed, it's right there looking at us. We see, for example, up there, top panel on the right, the warming hiatus, the slowdown in surface air temperature. We also see that that is just one attribute of the behaviour of the climate system. It's perhaps the only attribute in which we indeed see such a hiatus. Pretty much everything else keeps increasing or decreasing according to science. We also see something that for me is profoundly important about this picture, and that is the amount of effort that it represents. This is essentially all of the data compiled for all of these quantities, and it represents thousands, tens of thousands of person years of effort. Why is that important? Imagine we didn't have this picture. We'd be heading into climate change essentially not knowing what we were going into. And the fact that we know this is because of those tens of thousands of person years of effort, all of the observations, all of the interpretations that go behind that. That is truly important, and it's something that all of us, whatever end of this spectrum we're on, need to respect. The carbon quota is a very important, simple picture that captures the fact that the more carbon we put into the atmosphere, the warmer it's going to become, and the relationship between these two is nearly linear. That's the approximate relationship there. People sometimes mistake this as a simple linear relationship. It's not. In fact, it says that two things which are changing both in very non-linear ways, the amount of carbon we're putting into the atmosphere is going up nearly exponentially, and so is temperature perturbation from pre-industrial. That's the relationship we're seeing. It shows that these two highly non-linear processes are marching approximately in lockstep. It's got enormous policy implications, and those implications are sketched here. The attempt here is to show a few scenarios on what we have to do to stay under a carbon quota which would be consistent with about 2 degrees of warming. And the bars on the left show the carbon quota that we have to adopt if we stay below 2 degrees, the blue, 2.5, the green, and 3 degrees, the red. The quantity being plotted is how fast we have to reduce emissions in the long run in order to stay below those quotas. And you see that to stay below 2 degrees, with a 50% chance of doing so, we have to reduce emissions at just under 6% per year. That's an enormous task. That's a huge ask. Even if the warming limit were 3 degrees, we'd be looking at reduction rates in the order of 3% per year. And that is still a very significant change from where we are now, where emissions are climbing at around 2% per year. If we said, let's ask for a slightly better probability of meeting our target than 50%, let's ask for 66%, two-thirds. We land at the line represented by the turquoise bar there, the light blue, gives us a warming rate of well over 6%, nearly 7%. And here's the clincher. These are based on a view of the carbon quota, which is quite conservative. I won't go through the details, but if we change that view to the one that was adopted in the IPCC in the fifth assessment report, then our numbers change again, and they're represented by the orange and the yellow bars on the right, where, according to those criteria, the numbers you'll get from the fifth assessment report, we need to reduce emissions to meet the 2-degree quota by just under 8% per year if we are looking at a 50% chance of doing that, and about 9% per year if we're looking at a 66% chance. Those are enormous numbers. And for me, what this is telling us is that we have a real tension here between the facts which are laid out here and the values that we as a society are going to propagate into our set of decisions about this. So, last slide. I'd like to indulge in what for a natural scientist is a little bit of stepping outside of field and to talk about the relationship between values and science, and to put to you that this relationship is essentially about a continuum of modes of discourse, all of which are very good discourses to have. And they're discourses about matter, the sort of empirical things that we've been talking about our bodies, our minds, and our spirits, the choices we make for the values that we want, what we aspire to as well-being. And as we move through that hierarchy, if you will, of discourses, we move progressively from the objective at the bottom to the subjective at the top. And this is entirely fine and natural. All we have to do is to realise that that's what we're doing. However, we often don't. We find that subjective values the things that we value, trust, aspire to in terms of well-being, can and should take account of objective realities, but very often they don't. And one of the ways in which they don't is our current attitude as a society towards the science of climate change. We also find that in the Anthropocene in particular, that many objective realities are shaped by subjective values. We are shaping our world. We are making our world through the choices that we make. And the conflicts between these can be deep. Partisanship can undermine basic reasoning skills. People will flunk a math test simply because giving the right answer goes against their political beliefs. And the scariest thing about that finding, which was an empirical study by Kahn, is that the smarter they are, the more clever they are at flunking the math test and the more likely they are to do it. Nine argued that when people are misinformed, correcting errors with facts only makes them cling to their beliefs more tenaciously. And this leads to the issue of confirmation bias, which I mentioned a moment ago. It's something that those of us who nurture and protect fact need to guard against all the time. Confirmation bias is the tendency of everyone, including ourselves, to select evidence according to what we want to see. And there is, in fact, according to Nickerson, who wrote the fundamental paper about it nearly two decades ago, a recipe that we can apply to avoid confirmation bias. It is essentially to take the observations that we see as researchers in the world and to try interpreting those observations with the opposite of the hypothesis that we are believing to be true. And we need the ratio between the probability that the data can be interpreted with our hypothesis to the ratio that it will be interpreted with the opposite to be very, very different from one. And once we have that, and once we do that objectively and rigorously, we have some chance of guarding against confirmation bias. I'd like to conclude by reiterating the point that facts are difficult, they are hard to come by, they are worth nurturing, and that we need to pay them great respect throughout this debate. And as we move into the later talks in this set of four, people will move progressively through from fact to opinion and talk about what we do with our facts. But I'd like to leave you with the assertion that this is based around that facts and opinions are both important in climate change. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mike. And next, Mike, do you need a mic or will you just stand here? And I now welcome, speaking slowly so he can microphone himself before I introduce him, a psychological and social science perspective from Mike Smithson.
Thank you, Steve. Facts and opinions do indeed both matter. What I'm going to try to do is to give you a very quick tour through some facts about opinions. And what I'm going to do is to probably deepen the gloom a bit, at least at first, by talking about the ways in which the deck is kind of stacked against us when it comes to the sort of fact-value conflicts that Michael was talking about earlier. I'll start off by talking about psychological factors that stack the deck against us. First of all, concreteness and relevance matter. And unfortunately, climate change and its consequences are difficult to make concrete for people right now. It's always phrased in terms of something that's off in the future, something that might affect our children and our grandchildren and so on and so forth. For somebody at my age, 64, it's easy to think climate change is not my problem, right? It's their problem. And that's the difficulty. If we can't make things concrete and we can't make them here and now, then we tend to think about them abstractly. Secondly, it's difficult to make relevant to people right now. if climate change is viewed as something that's going to happen to the environment, that doesn't sound terribly relevant. If it's going to kill people or have impact on our health, that sounds a lot more relevant. So the framing of climate change in terms of relevance is terrifically important. And these two difficulties apply, unfortunately, most forcefully to people like us, people who live in developed industrial societies that are the biggest emitters. Self-efficacy matters. Most of us feel ignorant and powerless in the face of dread risks, especially global dread risks. Most of us don't really know about climate science unless we're specialists in the field. It's easy to think, well, what do I know? How do I know what I can do? And so on. Unless we believe that specific actions on our part can have an effect, we're unlikely to act, even if we do know the facts. And one real problem about telling people that they need to change their behavior in order to militate against something like global warming is it makes us wrong. People don't like being wrong. We like being right, and we like being good. We don't like being told that we're wrong or bad. So we need some ways to make people feel right, that they have a right way of doing things and that they can do it. So without a sense of self-efficacy, just knowing the facts, just being educated, is not going to motivate action. The ways we deal with the unknown also matter. Our intuitions about things like chance, variation, dynamics, unknowns, those crucially matter. And unfortunately, our favorite responses to uncertainty probably are maladaptive, specifically in regard to global warming and climate change. These two ways that are our favorites are, first of all, do nothing, right? Stop doing things until we find out more. Or status quo bias. Keep doing what we're doing and stick with the familiar things that are our habits and drives and so on and so forth until we're shown that we have to change. My co-authors and I have got a couple of papers out in which we've demonstrated, we hope conclusively, that greater uncertainty about the consequences of climate change actually imply a greater likelihood of very severe consequences. So, contrary to our intuitions, greater uncertainty about this issue actually constitutes a stronger case for action. This is a real problem, because this is a very strong intuition that all of us have, and that goes for me. All right, so much for the immediate tour through psychological things. What about socio-political factors? Political orientations and climate change beliefs matter. We've already seen an indication of this from a couple of the points that Michael raised. In a 24-nation, 17-language study with David Badescu's group, which I participated in, we found that regardless of nationality, regardless of language, belief that global warming is real amplifies perception of the likelihood of its consequences. Well, that should make perfect sense. But unfortunately, this is also true as well. Political conservatism and belief in a free market system decrease the perceptions of the likelihood of global warming consequences, regardless of and independently of one's belief that it's real. Identity matters. Arguments like Australia is responsible for only a small bit of the emissions, so we don't really need to do anything, is predicated on an identification of Australia as separate from the rest of the world. And of course, we know that that's not true. We can't privatize the atmosphere. We can't privatize the ocean. So we need a superordinate identification with humankind and with other nations to give us the moral impetus to do something, to realize that we are connected and that we're all in this together. We don't find risks or uncertainties out waiting for us in the real world. Most of us don't do first-hand reality testing very much at all. Most of us think we know the world is round. I suspect if I asked for a proof of this from most of you, you probably wouldn't be able to deliver it. Most of what we know is third-hand and it's socially constructed. The difficulty with this is that if we get sharp, disagreeing predictions by experts, we view those as worse than even vague but agreeing predictions by experts. We expect experts to disagree. And so sharply disagreeing experts engender a feeling of distrust. The media amplifies these effects, sometimes inadvertently, by adhering to a kind of an equal coverage norm, which is a professional norm of journalism. And of course, deliberate manufacturers of doubt are out there and doing work, oftentimes effectively, using techniques, strategies that are based on the kinds of things that Big Tobacco did to the American public during the 1950s and 60s to cast doubt on the link between smoking and lung cancer. Okay, so what can we do about all this? Well, what can I say? I think all I can do is point in a few directions, and Heather, I think, will be taking up some of these directions and amplifying upon them and providing more concrete material than this. We surely are going to need to take both psychological and social factors into account. Just giving people the facts and trying to educate the public isn't going to suffice on its own. So here are some suggestions for avenues that we could pursue. First of all, we must try to frame climate change as concretely and as relevantly as we can. We may need to make that as here and now for people as we possibly can. We need to build a sense of identification with humankind. We need to remind ourselves and each other that we really are all in this together. We need to build trust between the public, the government, and corporations. Just waiting for laws, regulations, enforceable or not, won't suffice. It won't solve everything. We need to persuade ourselves and others that we can make a difference, that we can be effective, and that we can do this, and that there are right ways to do these things. We should persuade journalists not to give equal time to discredited viewpoints. If we're going to educate anybody, let's educate them. A study by Holly Stocking and Lisa Holstein found that scientifically literate journalists did not give equal time to climate deniers and climate scientists, whereas scientifically illiterate journalists did, partly because probably it's a letout for them. And finally, we need to continue exposing outright deniers, flawed arguments, and vested interests. We really do need to do this because they're there, they're operating, they're strategic, and they're dangerous. Well, that's about it for me.
I've known Mike for a long time, and I'd never realized the resemblance until tonight. Now, for the perspective for someone who is a professional campaigner, Heather Broad.
Well, thank you. Going to pop this on. So, I guess it won't surprise some of you that I'm going to start with a little bit of a story. So, I grew up on a really beautiful farm in country South Australia, and it was a really fantastic place to grow up. And my parents dedicated so much to building the farm. And my mum used to joke that farmers and dad are sort of gamblers because you're always gambling, you know, sort of on the weather. And I guess that's what made it really hard when in 2008 we had the hottest November day in recorded history. And I still remember watching my dad's face when he was talking to the family about what it meant. And we were trying to get heaps of water out onto the vines to try and cool them down. And we lost 50% of the fruit flowers on our grapes. And it meant that we had 50% less yield the following year. This was really huge for me because it really made me realise that the 97% of scientists that agree that climate change is happening, they're actually talking about climate change that is already happening. And I realised that I had to do something because so few people were. And that's why I started a climate group. And it actually felt fantastic to have a sense of solidarity with people who wanted to take action as well and who shared that belief that, well, if I don't do it, who is going to? So in 2011, we started a campaign to try and get a price on carbon pollution. And it was really amazing to actually win that campaign. We got a price on carbon pollution and Australia started to reduce its emissions. And it felt amazing to be part of the movement that made that happen. It really did. And it was hard work. It was conversations about climate change. It was conferences. It was following people in animal costumes. Tony Abbott, mostly, in an elephant suit. Yes, I was an elephant for a while. And it felt really amazing to get that done. But right now, Abbott has torn down our price on pollution. We now have no broad price on carbon pollution in our economy. And it means that emissions have actually gone up since Abbott took office. So our challenge now is to kick Abbott out and actually get a price on pollution and other complementary policies. That is our challenge, and that's why I want everyone to come along to the People's Climate March on the 21st of September. I hope you all know about it, and it's actually happening at ANU, so it's going to be a really amazing opportunity to restore action, genuine action. So, facts and opinions are obviously interrelated when it comes to communicating about climate change, and I think the others have really set that up well. And I started with a story because I guess that's a big part of what I want to talk about. And I also really want to be vulnerable because it's important that we do that. And I appreciate that for everyone in this room, climate change is probably a really, really personal issue. I'm sure it makes you really upset, really angry, cry. And I completely feel that with you. And it's really, really hard. And sometimes it's too hard. But that's why this conversation is so vital, that we have this conversation, because it is really personal, but it's also something that we all share. And I've been thinking quite hard about what I've learned in this space to try and give you the most, you know, extract the marrow from what I've learned. But at the end of the day, you'll have your own unique perspective, and I don't profess to be an expert on this at all. So I guess if we're honest with ourselves, we know that people are not rational. That's why we don't interpret the facts of climate change the way, you know, ideally we should, which is being terrified. So really, to maximise benefits and minimise costs, which is what rational actors do, would be acting on climate change and getting rid of governments who don't want to act on climate change, but that's actually not what we've done as a society. We've put at the helm a climate skeptic. So clearly we're not rational, and clearly that means that we need to talk about what makes us change our mind about climate change, and that's where stories come in, stories like mine. So why do we tell stories? Sorry, I'm going to make you yell out stuff. Why do we tell stories about climate change? Why would we do that? Anyone?
Values.
Values, yes. Can be sentence as well. Pardon? Makes climate change relevant. Cool.
Stories are about getting over an obstacle, achieving an end.
Yes, they are. Yeah, so you overcome something. Yeah.
Stories are interesting and dramatic.
They're interesting, they're dramatic. You can swear. Yeah? Yell.
They can invoke or evoke emotion.
Yes, yes. Yep.
And so for that reason, people tune in the way they don't tune in to facts and will remember them.
Yes, people will remember them. Okay, great. Well, you're all experts, so. So they teach us how to act, all of the stuff that's just been said. It helps other people understand who we are, inspires us, connects us emotionally, all of that kind of stuff. So I guess I started with a story, and I'm best placed to tell my story, obviously, but I'm not best placed to tell your stories, but you all have good ones. You might not have thought too much about it, but you do. So very quickly, what you may or may not have realised is that the story that I told is something that I've been working on, at least the first bit of it, for a long time. And everything that I included in that story, I included for a reason. What I actually did was I went through a process of going through my challenge, my choice, and my outcome. My challenge was this huge issue of climate change, and it was impacting the people I love. It was impacting my family. And my choice was I felt, you know, like I couldn't do anything, and then I decided that somebody has to, you know, otherwise nobody will. And the outcome was I felt this amazing sense of solidarity with everyone. Then I told another story, a story about us, a story about how we got a price on pollution. We had no price, we got a price, and our emissions went down. And then I told you a story about now, a story about how we've lost our carbon price. We have a climate skeptic running this country, and we need to take action about it. So I've created this story in your head that stories happen like that, that there's a challenge, there's a choice, and then the outcome is positive. And that's what I did then, and I think that you'll probably be more likely to go to the People's Climate March because I told you that story, because you know that it's true. I've set it up. Is anyone going to go to the People's Climate March? Guilt tripping. Okay, good. But there are also five key beliefs that influence support of climate change, and they were things that I tried to include in my story and that I always try and include in my story. That's that climate change is real, people are causing it, 97% of climate scientists agree. It's happening now, has to be now. People don't care about the future. It's harmful to people, my dad, not necessarily the environment, but people. A lot of people here will care about the environment. That's lovely. But it has to be harmful to people. We can limit it. It's solvable. You don't have to be powerless. And nearly all experts agree. So that was the 97%. So I feel like those are really important key things that we've learnt about this topic. Two quick grasp before I go on to having conversations very quickly. And the key thing with this is that climate change needs to be relevant to people now. I think we do talk a lot about the future, and I think that's something that I want to emphasise is how much I've learned about making climate change relevant about what is actually going on around us now. Second thing to emphasise with this one, these are groups of people rated by how much they think climate change is happening. And when will it start to harm people? Well, people only care about climate change if they think that it's happening, you know, now. So it's really, really important to make it current and relevant to people in the present. To move quickly on to having conversations with people about climate change, the most important thing I think I've learned by trial and error and by talking to a lot of sceptics and wasting heaps and heaps of time is that you can't move people overnight from one end of the spectrum to the other. And debating with people on that side of it and getting disappointed when they don't completely change their view is just a waste of time. It really is a waste of your time. And, you know, like you, I'm an active supporter, probably. I'm just going to assume that there's not heaps of climate sceptics who are going to egg me after. So the most we can really do is shift people one step along the pathway here. And the more people who shift, the better. And the harder it will be for politicians to misinform and mislead us collectively. So, lastly, on having climate conversations, this warrants a huge discussion, but the key word that I want to get at, that I want you to remember about climate conversations that I've picked up, is that it's actually engaging people. So by the time you actually start talking about resolving their issues about, oh, well, did you actually know that the carbon price, 8 out of 10 households were actually better off, and, you know, they you know, whatever it is, like whether you're arguing about electricity prices or whatever, the most important thing is really that you've engaged them and listened to them and said, oh, okay, so you think that the carbon price is destroying Australia, or, oh, so you think that the planet's actually cooled, and so you think, yeah, so that's how, yeah, and let them do that. You know, talk less. And when you're actually at the point of engaging with people and having that conversation, it's heaps easier, and they've felt like they've been listened to and they've been engaged with and they've been valued. And you might not you might not get to that point, but you've probably taken them one step further than where they were. And the persuading is really about telling them your story. So that's where the personal story comes in, and the personal narrative comes in, and why it's relevant now. So I guess that's all. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much, Heather. And now the finale, almost. A science communications perspective from Will Grant.
I should have timed that exactly to start talking as Steve finished. It's been 30 minutes now since Steve gave you a bio about me, so I'm going to take a leaf out of Heather's book and be a little bit self-indulgent and dive in with a story. No, you weren't self-indulgent. I was going to take out a leaf out of your book and tell a story, and it'll be a self-indulgent story. That's a much better way of phrasing that thing. It's a self-indulgent story because I'm going to go through a little bit more of my bio. The bio that I gave Steve was just a short paragraph. I'm a political scientist by training, a political sociologist, actually. In my PhD thesis and the work that I've done, a little bit of the work that I've done since then, I read a lot of old dead German people and an old dead French people who didn't know a lot about climate change, probably because they died a long time before the rest of us actually knew about climate change. But in the last few years, I've been steadily moving to a place where I think about climate change more and more and more and more. I work on climate change more and more and more. I talk about climate change more and more and more. I write about climate change and about climate change policies, about climate change communication in a variety of popular media on the web and in newspapers and things like that. I get into fights about climate change online. I know I shouldn't. As Heather said, I shouldn't engage the active denialists in trying to convert them, but I do. I try to make sure that they do know the actual facts about climate change, and I'm trying to stop, but this is part of my personality. With colleagues, I've made a film about climate change and climate change communication. I've run climate change events. I'm changing my research direction more and more to start incorporating climate change communication, what we can do about climate change, what we know about climate change. It even comes up in conversations with friends. For some reason, Steve and Mike thought I was worth having enough into this forum that, you know, I might know enough about climate change to be relevant here. So what I'm going to say now is a little bit of a public confession. Just hear me up. I know the basic physics of climate change. I know that carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases trap more heat in the atmosphere. But when it comes down to it, I don't know exactly at the molecular level what exactly is happening. Something to do with infrared and hitting down at the... all right, I'll stop mumbling at that point. I know there's a basic physics involved. I know the history of emissions. I know that since the Industrial Revolution, the emissions that we've seen throughout the globe have just taken off like that. Sorry, Mike, I don't know the full details of the carbon quota, and I learnt a bit just then, so I'll be able to say a little bit more about that in the future. I know the global temperature trend, but I don't know enough about the hiatus, the warming hiatus, and whether I should mention the warming hiatus or not. I probably shouldn't. I don't know. I don't know enough about that. I know the rough history of the scientific detection of climate change, those 10,000 years of scientific effort. I know a little bit about that, but 10,000 years is an awful lot. I'd like to know more about that. I know a solid amount at the moment about when climate change entered mainstream discourse. And that's a really interesting thing, when it transformed from being a scientific issue into something that the rest of the world started to take seriously. I know a chunk about what climate change is doing and likely to do to sea levels, to violent storms, bushfires, to the poles, to ecosystems in the water and on the land, to crops and the lands that we farm, to food supplies, to economies, and to our health. But to be honest, there's just so much in all of those areas that I'd love to know more, but I still just don't. I know a little bit about what societies need to do to adapt. I know what they need to do to adapt to a 2-degree world, a 4-degree world, heaven help us, a 6-degree world. I hope it's not, you know, watch the movie The Road and then get all of your stuff into a shopping cart. I hope it's not that. But again, we don't really know enough about that, and I myself would like to know more. I know a solid amount about what the world needs to decarbonise, but more facts there. And finally, I know a lot about the communication of climate change. In particular, I know that all of these facts, all of the facts that we've shown, are not sufficient to engender action. There's an interesting follow-up to one of the studies that Mike mentioned before, that not only do our political beliefs predict how much we're likely to listen to different facts, actually, people that don't believe in climate change can actually still know all of the facts about climate change. They can know every single fact about climate change and just say, but I don't agree. Just doesn't help. So here's the thing. All of these facts, all of this world that we're in, I think, I don't know enough about climate change, but I'd be willing to bet that all of us in this room have massive gaps in our brain about the climate change picture. Even our esteemed colleagues down the front would have some gaps in what we need to know about climate change, whether it's in the space of physics, the space of adaption, or the space of mitigation. There is always more that we need to know because, and this is the really important thing, climate change is a massively complicated fact. It's a massively complicated fact. You know, we work with facts all the time. We work with the idea of gravity. You know, we drop something, it falls down. Over and over again, we can repeat that, we can see that. All the time, that works as a fact. It's a simple fact. The other Mike Smithson, mentioned that the fact that the world is round is a little bit more complicated. Because actually, we can't test it ourselves. We can only know that through complicated, abstract, empirical evidence. Importantly, there's no one that doesn't really care. There's no one trying to argue against the fact that the world is round. There might be a few flat Earth people out there. But climate change is a very complicated fact. We cannot observe it with our eyes. We cannot observe it with our fingers directly just here. We can only observe it through long historical data, through lots of series. We can only really see it in the journal articles. And so we need to work with this idea of this incredibly complicated fact, but it's an incredibly complicated fact that has an array of people organised against getting that fact out into discourse. So what do I want to say when thinking about the role of facts and opinion in climate change? I'd agree with every speaker that's gone before and say, of course, facts and opinion are absolutely critical to knowing what we need to do and to taking action. But the thing that I want to really draw on is that to get an outcome, as Heather said, we need an outcome at the end of the story. To get an outcome for what we need to do for climate change, I would want to argue to move away from the use of the word fact. To move away from the use of the word certain. We're in a dangerous place if we're ever arguing that what we need to take action on anything, whether it's climate change, whether it's what Vladimir Putin's doing in the Ukraine, whether it's tax policy, that we need certainty to act. We're in a very dangerous place if people have set the world up that we need to get certainty, because we will never, ever get certainty. We'll never get certainty on simple facts, and we'll never get certainty on climate change. And so if we've been set up with the idea that we have to have a fact, we have to have certainty before we act, we're losing the debate. We need to act because it's uncertain. We need to act because what the world we value is something that's important to us because of who we are and because of what we're doing. The final thing I just want to say is that, and this is a story about climate communication that I've observed over the last few years, is that I think we're doing this. I think we're moving to a world where 5 or 10 years ago, I'd come to talks like this, or I'd go to events, or I'd read people's writing, and over again, we'd be thinking, yes, what we need to do is hit people over the head with the hammer of facts until they are a relentless, quivering mass on the ground, and they'll just do what we say. I think what we're doing now is we're recognising that we need stories, we need to engage emotionally, and we need to connect with people and talk about what we value in the world and the risk of not acting. So I think, hopefully, things are getting better. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Will. And I'm glad Will said it, because I think while we've been focusing on climate change, the interplay between facts and opinion certainly relate to many other things, be it health, be it economy, be it international security. We now have questions and answers from one or more of the panel, and we have, well, the food and drink will be ready at 6:45, so it's up to you how long you wish to stay here. And we only have one roving mic because we've had a technological breakdown. Walter can run very fast and reach very far. And I would point out that the shorter the questions and the shorter indeed the answers, the more questions and answers there can be. It's a very simple equation. So, questions... Whoa. Well, you're going to have to help me here.
I think I saw an early hat here.
And I'm certainly going to expect questions from my left, where the future of the world resides.
I'm happy to start. Heather, do I need it? I'll just shout out. I was particularly struck by your comment about rationality in terms of the current government, but I do wonder if we have to think to ourselves if there is a rationale behind their action or inaction that perhaps we don't recognize in the context of looking at this problem from a scientific viewpoint.
Now, I was meant to say, if you could, if you're happy to identify yourself for questions so that people can understand who you are, can I identify you?
Yes, you can.
Oh, you can.
I'm Will Howard, and I'm at Uni of Melbourne. And
so, one or more?
Okay. It's an interesting question. I guess you could argue that... that there's a rationality behind, there's a rationale behind his position on climate change. I don't see it. At the end of the day,
I guess I'm wondering if we need to understand, if there is a rationale, we need to understand that.
Yeah, we do, because it's. I mean, a lot of people agree with him. So that's why we need to understand it. I guess my point really with that is just that it isn't rational to not, you know, to not deal with the problem. You know, we have to deal with the problem. So we have to understand the thinking and the logic behind that. And, you know, some of the evidence that that Mike talked about, Mike too, on... you know, those who, you know, believe in free market economics and blah, 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 are more likely to deny climate change, that kind of thing. So, you know, that's a real challenge. But there are people who, you know, believe in an unregulated market and small government, and who also think that we should act on climate change. So, you know, and they we should understand their thinking too.
John Aldo, Our next question. We have a white shirt there, and the person with the microphone, Graham, at the back.
Graham Barker, Research School of Biology. I'd like to ask the members of the panel, if they can wave a magic wand, what CO2 concentration you'd like to see?
What CO2 concentration would you like to see if you could raise a magic wand? Four numerical answers in quick succession.
Your left or our left? I'm gonna go whatever Mike says.
Me too.
Which Mike?
Yes. Mike the first.
That leaves me with the number, doesn't it? Graham, we've had this discussion, and I think what lies behind your question is that as CO2 is increasing, some things are happening which most people would agree are good. Among those are that plants grow faster. This has been a reality. It's the reason why we see what's called the land sink, the fact that about a quarter of the emissions of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere actually get taken up by the land biosphere. As CO2 concentrations continue to rise, other factors will start to fight it out. I'm not going to name a concentration in parts per million, except to say that concentrations in parts per million map very roughly into choices about the shape of the world that we want. And if we had a CO2 concentration of, say, double pre-industrial, pre-industrial was 280, we're now at 400, double would be 560, that would be a world that's of order 3 degrees warmer. And with the consequences that follow from that. If we had a concentration three times pre-industrial, it would be 4 or 5 degrees warmer. And those consequences are things about which we have choice.
I would have just picked a round number.
I'll just add one thing to that. I worry that a question like that in some ways is missing an important point. If I could wave a magic wand, I would like stability. I would like to decrease the rate at which change is occurring, and in particular, the rate at which acceleration of that change is occurring. So I'd be worried about, to put it technically, the first and second derivative is a lot more than a fixed level.
Okay, we have a cluster in the middle there, so you, and then pass it on to the ones near you. And I really do want to see a question from over this side.
Young people!
I'm young. I'm 23. Is it on?
We can hear you.
Okay. David, I'm a public servant in Environment Department. If we use opinions and emotion instead of facts, aren't we undercutting or subverting people's intelligence?
No. I guess it comes down a little bit to emotional intelligence is a thing. You know, I think it really is. And I think when we talk about values and when we talk about intrinsic and extrinsic values, it's actually really how we understand the world is through our lens of our values. So I don't think it is about undercutting, you know, or undermining the relevance or the seniority of science in this debate. It's just recognising, you know, the science of what changes people's minds, and it isn't facts.
I just want to add on to that. I think that we have to be really careful of thinking that presenting things only in a factual manner is highly intelligent and a safe way to go. You can present a whole list of graphs and numbers and tables about climate change, and they don't actually have any meaning in them. You can say what the current CO2 concentration levels are. You can say what the current global average temperature is compared with a certain level. You can say all of those things, and they don't actually say any meaning at all until you actually start saying, okay, what do I value? What do I want to keep? I want to keep the ice caps or I want to keep my parents' farm roughly similar to what it was before. And to be able to keep those things, you need to say, well, okay, what does the concentration of CO2 per million mean for that? So it's only when you start putting in, it's not necessarily opinions, but it's only when you start putting in the things that people value, stories, people, those kinds of things, that you actually get meaning in the data. Facts need that other bit of meaning to actually make sense.
Yeah, we'll have our next one, which was just there, and then down to the front here. I'm trying some geopolitical equity in the audience.
Thanks, Stephen. I'm Peter Kemmis. My question is towards Mike. And Ed Offa said it's some 17 years now since the pause has come in. You're saying 10, that's okay. But statistically, if that pause were to continue, how long would it need to continue for it to be statistically significant to the question of whether there was a cause-effect relationship between CO2 levels and global temperature?
Interesting one, and it's one that I ask myself often. And you can get some idea of it by looking at how often significant downturns in temperature have happened in the past record over a number of timescales. And we've had a 30-year downturn in temperature in the last century. We've had 100-year downturns several times over the last millennium. So these are not rare events. And the fact that the current hiatus in one particular attribute of the Earth system is occurring is certainly consistent with the levels of variability that we know the system exhibits. It's also consistent with what we understand about the exchange of heat between the atmosphere and the upper ocean, which go together, and the deep ocean. And that heat, in large part, can be found in the deep ocean. So I think the answer to the question is we would need to see the hiatus continue for a number of decades longer before we'd need to start reevaluating our basic understandings of the way the climate system works. And when we do that reevaluation, the answers that we come up with have to be consistent with all of the evidence that's available, and that includes the our observations of what's happening at present and our understandings of what's happened in the past.
We actually have here, and I really still am waiting for that hand to go up. Good, we've got one there. Well, let's start there to save while running around too much, and then down to the front here.
I'm a massive fan of renewables and energy, and I think that anything we can do to shift our energy production systems away from coal and away from oil towards renewable energy is the essence of the change. Now, obviously, now that the carbon tax is off the agenda, we're going to have to look at more expensive ways to force that shift. Probably what I would recommend, I think that new ways of funding renewables, the RET is a really important, the renewable energy target is a really important part for supporting renewable energy growth. It depends on what the various political parties do with the renewable energy target over the next while. I would love to see it expanded, you know, 20 to 50 to 100% over the next while. That's unlikely. If the RET is scrapped, then I think it gets kind of tricky. You know, if those tools get taken off the political table, you get more and more expensive ways to decarbonize, and that's just the fact of it. You have to have governments start building renewable energy rather than having a target that makes it cheaper.
My brother runs a solar photovoltaic company in Seattle. It rains a lot in Seattle. He pioneered this before there was a RET or anything like it, and he works with the state of Washington's policymakers to carve out policies that are going to help the renewable industries as well as making those sorts of steps affordable to the public. So we need activists both from the industrial sector as well as from the public and the government of this. But it can be done.
I think there are we have five actions we can take in the broad. First is a price on carbon. Okay, at least for the time being, we've lost that one. Second is incentives, and that's where the renewable energy target comes in and why it's so important and why the current debate about the RET is critical. Third is regulation. Some things ought to be regulated so that, for example, we have the regulatory framework that will help efficiency to improve throughout the economy, energy efficiency. Fourth is research and development. We need to know how to get to where we need to go, and stories about solar energy, about the many other forms of renewable, about energy storage. These are problems we know how to solve. And the fifth is community action, what's happening at community level is critical. So the fact that we've lost the battle on carbon, at least for the price on carbon, at least in the short term, leaves four others that are still vitally important.
Just here, and then... Yeah.
I don't know whether you can hear me. Can you hear me?
It's not on.
No, we are having a microphone problem.
Maybe we could use one of the speakers.
Come here.
My name is Judy Ryan, and I'm a climate realist. My question for you, for anyone in the panel, is when you talk about carbon pollution and carbon emissions, you're actually, I think, Will refer to it as carbon dioxide, which is what the full word is. It's carbon dioxide emissions. Carbon dioxide has two states. The gaseous state and its solid state is dry ice. Now, how can it be either a pollutant or a warming agent?
How can it be a...
Either a pollutant or a warming agent.
Okay. It is not a pollutant any more than water is a pollutant. It is a warming agent along with water vapour in the atmosphere, and it's a warming agent for several speakers alluded to physics, and that physics has been known for a century, that if the warming agents that we have in our atmosphere, starting with water vapour but including carbon dioxide and a number of others, were not there, Earth would be about 30 degrees cooler. It would be at about the average temperature of the moon and not a very nice place to live on. So the fact that there is a greenhouse effect is absolutely a given. The fact that it makes Earth habitable is a given. The fact that we can change it by altering the concentrations of some of these gases in the atmosphere is also by now very, very well established.
Actually, we'll just give up on our dysfunctional microphone. The front here, and then over there.
Okay, my name's Ian. I'm a member of the Greens and 350.org, the climate change activist group, and the Frank Fenner Foundation. And I'm involved with outreach about climate change. A question for Heather. From your knowledge and experience, do you think it's ever worthwhile criticising free market fundamentalism as the real reason that many individuals deny climate change? When you're talking with members of the public who may hold to that political ideology, or do you think that's fruitless and that you just really have to accept whatever political ideology a person holds and work within that?
I think that... No, whatever my answer is sort of, you know, by the by, because I think the fundamental thing is calling out vested interests and the fact that it's pretty obvious, and we know that the Liberal Party get huge fossil fuel industry donations. That's why the Greens are trying to set up ICAC and that sort of thing, as you'll know. So I think the issue is probably that, but that's just also personally, that's just my opinion. I think that opens up too much of another debate, and it takes away from the issue at hand, which is climate change, to be honest. That's my view on that. So I don't engage with, you know, we need to have a new world economic order stuff. And I also just don't know enough about it, and I did an economics degree, so it's that's my view. By the way, I'm just going to take this opportunity, because I have the microphone, to say that when we do finish up in a moment, there's a monster climate petition that's around, and there's a few people with clipboards, that's a petition to be tabled in Parliament, calling on the government to take strong action on climate change. So I encourage you to sign that on your way out.
You know, I think we can fit in two quick ones. Was there, was my next, and then, well, make it three. There are two hands up there. So really quick ones, because people might be getting hungry. And, yeah, and we'll just have to speak up.
John Morland, I'd like to ask that I've been looking at this climate change for about the last 7 years, and the number of predictions that have failed to materialise. The snow has been no snow by 2010. Sea level rises 4 metres somewhere between 2016 to 2021. That we have 5 years to save the planet. It was said by a former chief scientist, hey, we're 5 years now. And it's all right. If you're trying to get, is it any wonder that people on the ground start to roll their eyes when yet another article of Dragon's Breath comes out? Is it a wonder they roll their eyes and just turn the page over and just don't want to work no matter what they're all about? In other words, suggest that perhaps don't have these awful catastrophic predictions. Just get down to more of a rational debate of what a possible scenario would be and more comment.
One response.
Essentially, I couldn't agree more. And I did say that facts are traduced not only by the sceptic end of the debate or the contrarian end of the debate, but also sometimes on the other end.
Way up the back and then halfway down here. And try and lift your voice.
So, my name's Gary. I just wanted to ask a question about your answer. In the letters you mentioned, Helen, that the current government is not giving enough importance to climate change because they've taken the repeal of the carbon tax. How effective or how successful do you think it's going to be to find a government who actually looks more at environmental objectives rather than at, you know, trying to fix the current apparent deficit and, you know, focus on the economic objectives? Or will it be too late before we actually find a government who can successfully do that?
Brilliant question. And look, maybe, but maybe it will be too late. Two quick answers. First thing, we need to move away from the idea of two-party politics. It's not how the most progressive countries organise their democracies. That's my personal belief. The second thing I would say is that if we are not hopeful, then we're not going to get it done. So, and that's really massively important. So if we personally despair, well, you know, move on. Move on. It's just not worth doing. We're not going to get there if you want to be doom and gloom about it. So do it in your own time. I don't want to hear about it, is my view. And don't share that view with other people unless it's when you're having a personal chat with someone and you're going through a hard time, because that's not something that we should be talking about. You know, it's all going to go to shit. You know, we can do it. We will bloody do it.
Last question, Claire.
If people don't believe in the facts, how can you possibly go about starting to engage
in values? Find out what their values are first. I think there's no point actually talking about facts at all until you understand what they value, and then understand how the facts will affect what they value. You might not get to all of the facts up there in those charts that Mike put up before. You might get to only what they value and what they might care about their sports field. They might care about going scuba diving. They might care about millions of different things. And don't worry about all the facts. Just worry about the facts that are relevant to them.
Whenever I've looked at how people make decisions under uncertainty or even outright ignorance, I've often found that people do end up doing the right things, even when they don't know the facts. It's possible to do the right things even when you don't know. And just for the gentleman at the back, this is one of the cases where uncertainty actually helps us. If there's no uncertainty, there's no hope.
Can we take one more? Yes, okay, one last one.
I just wanted to speak in response as Australia's former chief scientist to your question. I'm aware of some things that have been bandied about, approval and various thoughts, and I believe that the remark that is attributed to me comes from a headline that appeared in the Herald Sun after a talk that I gave in December. So I looked into this, and I'm aware of what is being attributed that I have said. And maybe I could share a story here about what it's like to be a public figure. And in case you don't know, headlines are written by sub-editors. They're written by people that were not at the talk that I gave. I did not say what was attributed to me. And in fact, I looked back at my notes because I have notes from that talk. And in that talk that I gave in Melbourne, I said there is no magic date. That's what I actually said in that talk. I said the longer we wait, the harder it will get, the more expensive it will get, but there is no magic date. And that's what the former chief scientist said. I wish it had been reported, and I really wanted to share that with you.
We'll close the formal proceedings now. Apologies for the misfunctioning microphones. When we shifted venue, we lost control of the IT. And apologies for people I didn't get to. It's actually quite hard to remember when there are seven hands up at once. I feel like Tony Jones. I was asked to advertise, and there are some papers downstairs about a new initiative here, a relaxed and enjoyable research discussion called the Climate Cafe, which has already got coffee spilt on it. We'd be delighted if you could join us downstairs for refreshments, out the back door and down the stairs. But I would ask one round of applause for a few thank yous to Louise and Clive and Steve and the rest of the team and the volunteers who put this together. To all of you for coming along and to our four panellists.